We're back for season six, and to help me kick it off is director Brett Morgan talking about his David Bowie documentary, Moon Age Daydream. My name is Justin Hamilton, and I'll be a rock and rollin' bitch for you here on Big Squid. Thank you for joining me for a brand new season of the Big Squid podcast. Have you missed me? I've missed you. It should have come back much earlier, but someone was very lucky and got COVID for a second time. And let's not go on about it, because who gives a shit by this stage? But that's why it's taken a little bit longer for me to get this season kicked off. But we are ready to go, and we have quite a few podcasts in the back pocket, and I'll tell you more about that towards the end of this episode. We have an interview with director Brett Morgan talking about his David Bowie documentary Moon Age Daydream. I've been lucky enough to see it a couple of times now, so I'll share my thoughts up the top, and then we'll crack into the interview. And it's great. I got to ask him some questions that I had kind of opinions on, but I like to hear other people's version. Like, I don't necessarily think my opinion is correct. It's just, you know, my thoughts on the subject. And it was interesting to see where we agreed or disagreed or whatever. But he was great. And I was very lucky to spend a bit of time with him. So we will get into that very soon. Before we do that, of course, our Patreon shout out goes to Alan Halstead. Is it Halstead or Halstead? I should have looked that up, Alan. I'm so sorry. Alan has been a subscriber for a while now and lives in my hometown of Adelaide, South Australia. Heaps good. Alan, I hope you enjoy this episode. And since I know that you're a fan of The Dollop 2, keep an ear out for the end of this podcast. I've got some news that you might be very happy to hear about next week's episode. I wonder who it could be. You can take a 50-50 guess, I reckon, and probably work out who it will probably be. But anyway, I'll make that official towards the end. If you're listening and you'd like an episode dedicated to you, along with access to bonus podcasts, scripts and more, head to patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid and you will find a tier that suits you. And also being a part of the Patreon gets you quite a good bonus off any tickets to live shows that I'm doing. And I have a few live shows coming up. If you're in Adelaide, the live Big Squid podcast recording at the Rhino Room is just around the corner. That is happening on the 16th of September. And if you went across this, just sit back, because this is just a random gig in September, and the podcast will feature Rove, Will Anderson, Tom Gleason, Georgia Mooney, Adam Richard, Mickey D, Limo, and making his South Australian debut is Ben Elwood. And it will be a night of us talking about all the art and entertainment that shaped us into the acts we are today. Now, I've released some extra tickets for you, and my listeners can get money off their ticket price by using the code BIGSQUID. That's for everyone who listens to this podcast. And remember, if you're a Patreon subscriber, you have your own code that will get you even more money off. That's up at the Patreon site. But for everyone listening to this podcast, Big Squid, all lowercase, one word, and get yourself a discounted ticket. This is going to be a big show. So if you're keen to come along, like, I know times have been tough and people kind of like to wait until the last second, but I've had to release new tickets for it and I've kept it as cheap as possible. So it's a real opportunity to see some of the legends of the Australian comedy scene all in the one place talking about stuff that they love. Also, while I think of it, my new stand-up show Little Victories will be appearing in Sydney at the Comedy Store on the 28th of October and Comedy Republic in Melbourne on the 26th of November. Head to bigsquidpod.com, and if you go to the blog section, you'll find a blog that has all of the live details there and what to expect. And I'm really looking forward to getting back on stage with this brand new show. Okay, I really want to talk about this movie. So first up, I'm going to share some thoughts with you on Brett Morgan's documentary Moon Age Daydream.
Are you there, David?
You're aware of a deeper existence.
Are you there, David? Are you there, David?
Maybe a temporary reassurance that indeed there is no beginning, no end. And you find yourself struggling to comprehend a deep mystery.
There might be some of you who are new to the podcast, and I'll just do this quickly for people who have not listened before. Apologies to my regular listeners. You've heard me bang on about David Bowie for a long time. But just to sum up, I've been a fan since my mum took me to see him perform in his Sirius Moonlight concert at the Adelaide Oval on the 9th of November, 1983. That is far out. I'm coming up to a big anniversary for that. I've just realised, oh God. Anyway, I was mesmerised from the first song, which was Look Back in Anger. It was from the Lodger album. I did not know that song. He came out with his back to the audience singing the first verse, and then when the chorus hit, he spun around and all the lights hit and the music swelled and the crowd screamed, and I was like, great, I'm in. I don't quite know what's going on, but this is my guy. And at that point, I only knew the hits like Space Oddity, Ashes to Ashes, and Let's Dance. But Mum took me along because she kind of had an inkling he was the type of artist I'd get into. And I think she could see where I was leaning creatively at that point. And so she just kind of knew this was the person that I should be checking out. So she asked if I wanted to go along and see the concert. The tickets were really expensive. They were $20. $20. And I went along and, well, it turned out it was a bit of an understatement when Mum said, oh, I think you might get into this guy. So I've never wavered in my faith in Bowie. I've never met a Bowie album I didn't like on some level. And I followed him religiously right up to his death in 2016 and beyond. And when I heard there was a documentary coming out, I just hoped at the very least it would be good. Turns out I set my hopes too low. Moon Age Daydream by Brett Morgan is fantastic. I've loved every second of it. And, you know, I plan on seeing it all the times at the cinema. Like, it really, really thrives in the cinema. Like, if you enjoyed seeing Bohemian Rhapsody, which I think objectively is not necessarily a good film, but the music sounded great, right? Like, you're sitting in a cinema, you've got those big cinematic speakers and the music hits you right in the chest. Well, this is the same experience, except you're hearing from the actual artist. There's nothing that you have to kind of wade through to get to the good parts. Because, look, going in, my fear was that this was going to be another documentary where you watch famous people talk about how much they love Bowie. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate the irony in that I'm banging on about my love for him, but a few minutes on a podcast is very different to sitting in a cinema for a couple of hours while you hear someone like, I don't know, Boy George or Moby talking about their experiences. This is great. What Morgan has done is he has been given permission by the David Bowie estate to go through all the footage they have in storage, and through use of concerts and interviews with Bowie, were given a taste of the great man's life. And of course, this is through the prism of the director. So what we're watching is Morgan's relationship with Bowie. And it's interesting, if when you go to see it, if you remember, it takes on quite a greater significance when you learn that Brett Morgan nearly died not too long ago, had a massive heart attack, ended up in a coma. And I think that's kind of what lends a real positivity to this movie, which I'll talk about a little bit more later on. The documentary opens with a quote from Bowie, who in turn quotes Friedrich Nietzsche, who speaks about an ongoing search for selfhood. And we see Bowie's name spelled out beginning with the letter O. And this is a statement on the structure of what we're about to experience, which is a circle. The documentary moves through Bowie's life in a loose chronological structure, but also circles back to the past, through to the present, and into the future to make important points. Now, if that sounds a little bit confusing, just imagine we kind of move through his career in the shape that you would expect from A to Z, as it were. But at any given point, wherever we are in the structure, we're taking interviews from the past and future, and the same with the music from the past and the future, to tell that story. So nothing is limited to just that era. So the best example I can give you is in 1983, when Bowie reaches the height of his popularity, where this is the Let's Dance era, and he is massive, and he's never been as big as this. And that's kind of where some people decided that he lost his way. Even Bowie himself said, you know, the mid to late 80s and early 90s was him kind of grasping to reinvent himself in a way that he felt comfortable with. So when we see Bowie at this point, the music that's playing underneath is Rock and Roll Suicide, which is a song that ends the Ziggy Stardust album, and it's about when the perfect plastic pop star falls from grace and is kind of torn apart by his fans. So we move forward through the story, even as we hear Bowie talk from different moments in his timeline, reflecting and reframing, learning new truths and redefining old thoughts. As Bowie says, "The truth is, of course, that there is no journey. We are arriving and departing all at the same time." And this is what the circle represents. The Bowie experience doesn't begin or end, it's eternal, and you can join in on that experience at any moment. We not only see Bowie's career in all the different forms, but we see his life interspersed with all manner of pop culture that influenced his career or spoke of the times that he strode across the world in high heel shoes and feather boas around his neck. German expressionism rubs frames with 50s horror and science fiction, and Bowie's film clips appear edited and reformed for new context. The movie triumphantly opens at maximum volume with the 90s industrial glam stomp of Hello Spaceboy. And what I really love is it also moves through a lot of his hits, but some of those hits are in new forms, like you'll get a kind of new version or a different version of Life on Mars. But you also get some really beautiful deep cut tracks. There is an album called The Buddha of Suburbia. It is a lost Bowie masterpiece. Not many people really know about it, even the big fans. It's a beautiful album. It came out in between Black Tie White Noise and The Outside album. And it's kind of a soundtrack, and he's working on ambient music, and I think that's where he really starts to find his groove again. And you hear tracks from that play all the way through it, and it's great. All art, of course, is subjective, and it is important to remember that this movie is from Morgan's view of Bowie. So your take on David Bowie might be different, and you know, mine is probably different to you. I think we would all have our own song choices that would clash with each other. You know, like when we see clips in this, we get anthems like Heroes. The moment with Heroes is fantastic. And that's, to be completely honest with you, not one of my favourite Bowie songs. Like, I think it's great, but it's not in my, you know, top tier. But this live version is magnificent. And then you get deeper cuts like The Wild-Eyed Boy from Free Cloud. And that's taken from the Ziggy Stardust concert. And it's great. But, you know, there were songs that I would have liked to have heard. But then I was also really surprised and, you know, really excited by some of the songs that I wasn't expecting. So, you know, even if it wasn't all the songs that I would have chosen, I kind of felt a little bit relieved. Over the last few years, I've strayed from the glam period of Bowie's music, but seeing and hearing it in the cinema again through those big speakers and that surround sound, it's really reignited my love for that era. And I've been thrashing the Ziggy Stardust and Aladdin Sane albums, and even going back to, you know, that kind of hard to describe album Hunky Dory, which is a masterpiece. And yeah, just that period I've just really enjoyed, and it's all because of watching this documentary again. I was prepared to find moments in this documentary upsetting. I was prepared to be sad that Bowie is no longer with us, but interestingly, these emotions never appeared. Instead, I found myself engaged creatively and emotionally. And the two times I've seen this film, both times I've wanted to run out into the world and grab life in all my arms so I can just squeeze it and get to work. I think if you're just a person who likes his music, This will be a great experience. If you love his music, I think you're going to be blown away. And I think if you're a creative person, you're going to find that the fire begins to burn even brighter inside. I found it really inspiring, and I was not expecting to feel that alive when I came out of it. And as I said, I was quite prepared to be a little bit sad, and that just never happened. It was just a beautiful, beautiful experience. And I think this is just a masterpiece. And I, as I said before, I will see it all the times. See, this isn't a documentary about the man David Robert Jones, who was born on January 8th, 1947, and died on January 10th, 2016. This is about David Bowie. This is the rock star. This is the action man. This is the larger-than-life figure who not only entertained us, but opened a creative and artistic world to the masses that a lot of us never even knew existed or didn't even know our way into. He was always a fan, and he never stopped sharing his fandom with us. It's an important lesson that I took on from a very young age, and I'm very grateful because it's even at this age, I'm still discovering new things and I'm still excited about going and searching. Moon Age Daydream is all about the myth of David Bowie. And as we know, myths never die. I hoped at the very least to enjoy this documentary. As I said, that's kind of what I was hoping. Just enjoy it. And to come out of it inspired and ready to take on the next day, that was an absolute treat. It was a real pleasure and privilege to sit down with Brett Morgan. He was an absolute delight, and the only thing that I could say negative about this interview is, damn, I wish I could have had 3 hours with him. I would have picked his brain for that whole time. He's probably very grateful that he didn't have 3 hours with me. He would have been like, fuck, it's enough, enough. All right, enough of me. Let's bring in Brett Morgan.
I've been very lucky to have seen your work twice now. I got to see it on the Friday. I got to see it last night as well. And so many questions for you, but what I noticed on the second viewing is that when you spell out his name at the start, you begin with the O, yeah. And it feels like a statement of intent that we're going to circle back at the end to the beginning. And there's all these little loops all the way through the movie where it's, you know, wherever we are chronologically, we're hearing from the future, we're hearing from the past to inform. When in the process did you realise that was the structure of what you were working on?
I think really early on, you know, Bowie, one of the themes that is constant through his work is the idea of the double or doppelganger, and I probably best expressed in the song Man Who Sold the World, when he runs into a future version of himself going up the stairs. And so this idea and the themes that Bowie gravitated towards, he didn't sort of arrive at a theme, explore it, exhaust it, and carry on. He did that with stylings and genres, but philosophically, he kind of was engaged with the same questions of mortality and spirituality and transience throughout his creative life. And so, you know, probably best exemplified by the connection between Silly Boy Blue, a song that he wrote when he was 17 years old, and Black Star, a song he wrote right before he passed. In Silly Boy Blue is a song that is, well, it for me, it might be about Buddhism and reincarnation, as it's filled with a tremendous amount of that sort of imagery. And at that time, David was interested in possibly living in a monastery and studying Buddhism. At the end of the song, as the song's fading out, there's a harmony line or melody line where you hear a sort of chanting. It's sort of ooh. And then if you flash forward to Black Star.
Yeah.
That's the middle bridge of Black Star.
Yeah.
Black Star, also a song about reincarnation, also a song that he did at the very end of his life. And so he's having this conversation across time. And so from the very beginning of the film, I love this idea that he would be narrating about himself.
Right.
And so at the start of the film, when he comes out and does Free Cloud, a song that I interpreted to be quite sort of lonely and sort of whatever David's intent was, I don't know, but I interpret and express that as a sort of song about wandering and alienation and loneliness. And so I inserted shots of David from 1983 underneath David singing Free Cloud in 1973 to kind of posit that he's singing about himself in the sort of future tense. And then conversely, when we get to the Flame Out in the 80s, I cue Rock and Roll Suicide.
One of my favorite bits.
Yeah, to have it. Because, you know, I had a choice, right? I could have played, you know, Never Let Me Down.
Right.
And used that to illustrate that he was flaming out. Or I could play a real great song that better illustrates and articulates and, and sort of foresees what the dangers he might be confronted with down the road. So it was a very Bowie-esque element that I don't think would be applicable if I were doing a film on the Stones or Kurt Cobain or anything like that. It was very sort of specific to Bowie, and the idea of repetition when I was cutting the film, I would audition shots in different sections. I would say, well, maybe, because I'm still on the rough stage, so I'd say, okay, let's take this escalator shot and put it here. And then maybe I'll use it here, and then we'll ultimately decide which one it plays better in. And I started to really appreciate the connections I was making between scenes through the repetition of imagery. And I acknowledged that they were mistakes. But there are no mistakes. Right. That's what I learned from Bowie. They became happy accidents. And there was a point in this film where my wife, who's my my producer and the only person I listen to, kept saying, you still haven't got rid of that extra escalator shot. Yeah. And I was like, no, I know, I'm going to do that next week. And I just got to the point where I was like, I know it's wrong, but it's not. And I enjoy it, so I'm just going to leave it.
Oh, I loved all of those moments. Yeah. It kind of lends an ethereal vibe to it, coming back to those moments. And they always came back at, regardless if they were technically mistakes, they always felt correct when you came back to them. I deliberately didn't do any research in the lead up to this, so then I just went in and experienced.
Oh, you went in cold?
I went in cold to the movie. I knew you were making it. I saw the trailer. I went, I will see that 727 times at the theater, but I'm going to go in and experience it.
You saw the trailer, though?
I saw the trailer.
So you weren't totally cold?
Not totally cold, but I didn't want to do any research on you in the lead up to it. I just wanted to experience it. And when I first came out, really optimistic. I felt really happy. And I also felt creatively, positively charged. It was both times I've come out going, oh, I'm going to be up all night just creating. So then when I read that you had that awful experience with the heart attack and you were in a coma and, awful for your family as well. So when you were making it, was it a deliberate choice to make something that was this uplifting, or did you find yourself halfway through the process going, oh, this seems to be, leading in a more optimistic area?
It wasn't like a eureka moment.
Yeah.
But at the very start of the process, January 5th, 2017, I had a heart attack and a flatline for 3 minutes. Or close to 3 minutes. I wasn't there to keep count. Right. My wife keeps saying it wasn't really 3 minutes. It was a long time. It felt like an eternity.
Right.
I flatlined. I was in a coma for a week, and that wasn't because of the work on Bowie. It was because of everything that preceded it. And I had been. My friends like to say that I'm very much like my films. I'm like kind of a tsunami.
Right.
I'm not very subtle. I go hard at life, and I take my work home with me, and it's very stressful. And so my life had no balance.
Right.
And And so, you know, I almost died. It was my kid's birthday. And you start, I was asking myself, so if I had died, what would be the thing that my kids would say, Dad always used to say? And I couldn't think of what that was. I didn't know what that was. My Father's Day cards are always the same every year since my kids were like seven, which are like, hey, Dad, thanks for showing me how to work hard. You know, you're an amazing role model. And what amazing role model, I'm dead at 47. That's not the legacy I want to leave for my children. My life was not good. There was no balance to it or symmetry. And it was with that frame of reference that I started to listen to David's interviews. And I found that I was gaining tremendous inspiration through him, and that this film would offer an opportunity to create a kind of roadmap for how to lead a successful and fulfilling life in an age of chaos and fragmentation. And should something happen to me, that my kids would always be able to turn the film on and know that this is the sort of message that I want to share with them.
Yeah, it's a fascinating experience to kind of get to the end, because I was quite prepared to possibly be, you know, a bit sad during the whole experience. But early on, it was a little bit, you know, because I saw the Ziggy Stardust concert when first came out in 83. Mm-hmm. That's when I sort of kind of discovered Bowie. And then so that bit was a bit like, oh, this is emotional. And then the rest of it just feels really joyful. And as I said, you come out just, all right, let's take on the world. Let's do this right now. It's such a great feeling. Your use of music and imagery is so beautiful. Was there any song that you loved but just couldn't fit into the narrative at any point?
I do have a weakness for Under Pressure, which... I was sort of torn about using, because it's so associated with Freddie.
Yeah.
And more importantly, at the time, I'll tell you, you've seen the film twice now, I had that as the underscore for his in the 80s when he was flaming out.
Oh, right.
And the scene never worked. And I couldn't figure out why the scene didn't work. And it didn't work because you're hearing ding, ding, sticky, ding, ding. And you're sitting there going like this, bopping to it. And meanwhile, it's like I'm trying to get to this place where he's like flaming out. And one day I was just like, and went 180 degrees and took it out through Ian Fish and was like, oh.
Right.
It's so obvious.
Yeah.
And perhaps if I had someone that I was collaborating with, I would have saved myself countless weeks. But this was the problem with working by myself, which is someone else could have walked in on day one, said, you're using an upbeat song. That's your problem.
Yeah. Like,
but it was, I had to work through these issues.
That's such a funny thing to kind of realize, isn't it? Hang on, this is a downer, but this is triumphant. Why is this not quite matching up how I want it to?
And there are a lot of instances like that where it's just like the writing is right there, but you know, you're just kind of like blind by your own, I don't know, whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, was there an era that you found yourself drawn to more than any others, or were you pretty evenly spread out?
During the research and screening process, I was completely committed to balancing David's post-95 work with his more celebrated work from the 70s.
Right.
It was my intent to provide a level playing field. And I think the last sort of echoes of that are Hello Space Boy at the top of the film. What I discovered when I reached my first assembly was that in the film, he meets Amon, and shortly thereafter, there's a performance of Hello Space Boy Live. And the purpose of that performance is like, he's back, he's got his thing. And then I found anything that would happen after that just felt gratuitous.
Right.
And so I wasn't able to explore it. I think that audiences might walk away thinking I try to write off or dismiss the last 20 years of his career, but that's, in my opinion, a sort of faulty read on the film based upon the covenant the film is providing, which is clearly not about a chronological catalog of all of his achievements. It's really about his kind of creative and spiritual sort of journey. And when he arrives at Amman, he arrives at a plateau and sort of stays there. So I felt that we had completed our story.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that 90s era I find particularly fascinating because, having lived through it as a Bowie fan, people kind of forget it wasn't front of mind for a lot of people. Like, you had Britpop coming through, you had Nirvana covering him, but you know, you still had the Enemy Express, you know, writing cruel reviews about Outside, kind of missing the inherent humor in his work as well.
I think what happened to David in the 90s is older music critics rejected him for the same reason that younger music critics did, because they thought he was trying to jump on the bandwagon. And what they failed to recognize was that's what Bowie has always done.
Yeah.
He, you know, goes and hears the Velvet Underground and then puts out his own version of it.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily sound like the Velvet Underground. It sounds like Bowie. And I think that's what he's always done. And so I think that when we go back and we listen to Earthling today, and you listen to a song like Little Wonder, it's magical. It's as good as anything he's ever done. It's just at the time there was too much resonance and too much baggage for people to really kind of view it along as I think it should have been handled.
I feel like it always got misconstrued as a drum and bass album, which it isn't. It's a rock and roll album that uses drum and bass to kind of give it a propulsion, you know. Interestingly enough, a lot of my friends' kids are into Bowie, 5 years old, teenagers, young adults. Why do you think he still appeals to such a younger audience, even at this stage?
Well, I think with the little kids, like under eight, it's the cartoon nature of the Ziggy persona.
Yeah.
I think is, and the music, some of the more pop songs, Let's Dance, and they're very easy to listen to. And he's, you know, he would have made a great Saturday morning cartoon character. In fact, I George Underwood, I think one of David's friends, told me that they went to pitch an ABC Saturday morning cartoon series in the 70s about Ziggy Stardust, and he showed me the character design.
Amazing.
On it.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I think that
Little Ziggy.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that the reason Bowie still resonates is because he was writing about subjects that resonate with us today. Obviously, you know, in the most obvious sense, his discussions and ideas and about gender fluidity are finally coming into the light. I think it's he's, you know, as I said, he was writing music that was really describing the moment we're in. More importantly, I think, and what I find so interesting, is when I was coming of age in 1981, before we had the internet, it was hard to find your tribe.
Yeah.
And Bowie waved a flag that was far and wide and basically invited anyone who is not part of the mainstream to participate. And I'm particularly think that, you know, for those of us who felt like freaks or alienated or confused about our sexual identity, there weren't many other role models. So that sort of incredible function. What I find particularly fascinating is in the age of the internet, in this century where young adults have access to a myriad of different sources, there still seems to be a bit of a rite of passage when kids turn 12 or 13 and they become aware of David Bowie. and find the same sort of comfort that I found when I was 12. And I think that maybe because he, because he's speaking to them, and B, seeing him presenting himself in that manner against the sea that he was, you know, of controversy, and as you see in the film, his kind of smile, you know, the way he was smiling away the criticism and just kind of embracing all of his peculiarities and oddities, and I think it's quite appealing.
Part of what I loved was the, I think it's underestimated how funny he was and what a great sense of humor he had. And it's, your movie's funny. Like, there's lots of funny moments all the way through it.
Not enough. And I think that's where the film fails in any way, shape, or form from being a documentary of David Jones. I think David Jones was hilarious.
Yeah.
And Bowie is not as funny.
Right.
And I had a, I collated all of like my favorite humorous Bowie things into like a bin and was hoping to sort of exercise them. And it just, the film didn't really invite too much of it. There are those moments that come up, which are quite, that I find quite charming. But he was, he was, you know, incredible. He was, he was incredibly funny, and I think not as lonely as depicted in the movie. Again, this was based upon Bowie's own musings and the way that he was presenting his life. And so I think one gets the sense watching the film that he like had no friends and, you know, lived a monk's existence, which again is not entirely reflective, but I think what's interesting is in the context of which we view Teenage Daydream, and you get to that period post-Berlin where he's wandering and he talks about how he doesn't, never wants to have a home. I think that in that moment, as he was saying it, as the culture viewed him, it, that idea was almost celebratory. But there's an air of pathos to it that I experience in the film, and perhaps being the one moment where looking back, we can see that he hadn't. We now have the keen insight of time to reflect back on it, but it does seem that there was some psychological damage from his childhood that needed, that was preventing him from going home, that he needed to work through.
Brett, it's been an absolute treat talking to you. I honestly could have taken up all of your time. Thank you not only for the great work, but I'm glad that your health's back on track for you and your family. So thanks for sharing some time with me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you to Brett Morgan for being my guest on the podcast. Moonage Daydream hits theatres on September 15 all over Australia. And if you're overseas, head to the official David Bowie Instagram site or just his website. You can find where it is opening all over the world. I'd like to send out a thank you as well to Louisa and everyone else at NBC Universal for making this happen. Look, if you can make it to the cinema, go and treat yourself. You'll have a blast. You want to feel that music hitting you in the chest. You want to see the visuals on the big screen. It's been mixed to just bounce around while you're sitting in the chair, from coming at you from all angles, and it's a real experience. So if you can, head to the cinema and have a really good time. Thank you to our Patreon subscriber for the episode, Alan. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you'd like to have an episode dedicated to you and access to extra podcasts, scripts, sometimes there's early looks at upcoming work, all sorts of things, head to patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid to find a tier that suits you. Adelaide friends, remember, we'll be recording live at the Rhino Room on September 16th. Yes, the day after the Bowie album comes out. Why don't you just do yourself a favour, as Molly Meldrum used to say, and go and see Bowie on the 15th and come and see us on the 16th and have the two greatest nights of entertainment that you've had in at least in 2022. I'll feel very confident about backing that up. If you want to come along, I've just released the last of the tickets, so head over to adelaidecomedy.com and remember to use the promo code BIGSQUID for cheaper tickets. And Patreon subscribers, remember to use your super duper promo code for an even cheaper ticket. Next week, there'll be two podcasts coming your way. First up will be a new mini podcast segment called Chitter Chatter. That will drop Monday mornings. It's a very short podcast. And what I'm doing is I'm bringing in a couple of people who will give you some topics that you can use to start conversations for the week. You know, the world's in a pretty shitty place. Everything's quite depressing. So we've got a whole bunch of just interesting facts that you can walk in and say, hey, did you know, blah, blah, blah. And hopefully that gives you something else to talk about than how awful the world is. And speaking of how awful the world is, the big podcast for the week will be with the Dollops, Dave Anthony. Yes, Dave and I will be discussing how awful the world is. But, you know, in that Dave Anthony way, we also have a little bit of pop culture chat that might take you by surprise. Turns out we've both been watching The Sandman. At that point, I was halfway through the series. So maybe I'll do a Sandman episode for you later on. But that will be a good, fun chat with Dave Anthony next week, so keep an eye out for both of those podcasts. And over the next few weeks, we have Parsi Amel coming back. We have Nick Kennedy, a drummer in Imperial Broads, who is touring, talking about his career. We have a two-part Space Podyssey, just Rove and me. They're all ready to come up. Oh, and also Brisbane comedian Bron Lewis, who has become a new friend of recent times after we did a week of gigs, and I think she's just great. So we have a lot of fun stuff coming up for you in the next couple of months. Let's finish today with a quote from David Bowie. All art is unstable. Its meaning is not necessarily that implied by the author. There's no authoritative voice. There are only multiple readings. It's great to be back. Thank you for joining me. Until then.